Matter of State versus Jerry Rosado. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Is the court section prosecutor's office of the state? My
colleague,
Jeffrey Sutherland, who's the prosecutor of
Cape
May County.
He will not be able to. Morning. Morning, Your Honor. Richard Pompilio, New Jersey crime victims law.
Good morning,
Your Honor.
Mark
Gainberg,
Assistant Deputy Public Defender. Good morning, Your Honor. Jess B. DeVito, Johnson High Mobile Occasion, on behalf of.
Good morning, counsel, and welcome. Ms. Pickering, please. We're going to go, for everyone's info, till roughly 12:30, maybe a little bit over, so we may need to pick up after a half-hour break for the balance of the argument. I'm not trying to rush you, Ms. Pickering.
I understand. Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice and Honorable Justices of the Supreme Court, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal at the end of the argument today.
That's fine.
New Jersey courts have never recognized an elemental right to avoid prosecution, criminal prosecution, due solely to the passage of time. The statute of limitations reflects a balance between the strong public interest in punishing the guilty and protecting a suspect from being put to his defense after memory has faded and evidence lost. The statute of limitations is a legislative creature. For these reasons, the legislature has seen fit to amend the statute of limitations to reflect societal norms and mores, and to also reflect scientific advances in criminal investigation. The reliability and accuracy of DNA evidence has significantly attenuated the second foothold supporting the statute of limitations. The 2002 DNA exception at issue here was passed precisely because the accuracy of DNA in identifying suspects many years after a crime has been committed and should be allowed to apply to the instant case. Very briefly, because I know you're familiar with the facts after reading the briefs, but on May 27, 1990, Susan Negersmith was found behind a restaurant in Wildwood, the victim of a sexual assault and homicide. Biological evidence taken from fingernail scrapings and a vaginal smear were analyzed and found to contain an unknown DNA profile. Toxicology taken at the same time, those results showed that the victim was highly intoxicated. In spite of these investigative efforts, the identity of the perpetrator remained unknown. In 2018, however, a novel technology became available, genetic genealogical analysis. And this technology, which ultimately identified Jerry Rosado as a person of interest in 2021. I want to take a quick moment aside to identify an error in the appellate division decision, which said that Mr. Rosado was identified in 2018. He was not. He was identified in 2021 after the 2.5-year process of the genetic genealogical analysis was done. And the identity was to a relative of his, and that led to further investigation. And in May of 2022, a buccal swab was taken from Mr. Rosado, which was compared against the DNA evidence that was found inside the victim. A forensic scientist reported a very high statistical probability that the sperm and other biological matter recovered from the victim was defendant's. Defendant was charged in April of 2022 with second-degree sexual assault on a helpless or incapacitated person. And that was the 1990 law that he was charged under. In 1990, the applicable statute of limitations for sexual assault was a general 5-year period. As discussed in the state's brief, and I will not go into greater details unless requested, in the early 1990s, the New Jersey legislature began enacting statutes recognizing the importance of DNA in identifying suspects in criminal investigations, eliminating the statute of limitations for sexual assault, and correspondingly amending the statute of limitations to reflect the accuracy of DNA and the need to hold unidentified offenders accountable. The legislature recognized that DNA evidence is unparalleled in its ability to connect defendants to crimes where their DNA was found long after that crime has been committed. The 2002 DNA exception reflects this. The statute is clearly retrospective in application and should not be read to be prospective only. While the language "take effect immediately" typically directs prospective application, this presumption may be overcome where the legislature clearly intended a retroactive application, as this court has noted in JV and Lane. This legislative intent may be express, And this is a quote from Lane, that is stated in the language of the statute or in the pertinent legislative history or implied. That is, it may be necessary to make the statute workable or give it the most sensible interpretation. Here, the pertinent legislative history for the 2002 and the 1996 amendments clearly expresses this intent for retroactive application, and such application is necessary to make the statute workable and give it the most sensible interpretation. In declaring this prosecution barred by the five-year statute of limitations, the appellate division marginalized the clear legislative intent, overweighted the significantly diminished protection of a defendant from stale evidence, and cast aside the recognition by the legislature and the courts unparalleled accuracy of the DNA evidence. All of this in favor of the defendant's right to prompt prosecution and protection from stale evidence. Since 1996, the legislature has discounted these concerns as regards sexual assault when it eliminated the statute of limitations for sexual assault, applying it to cases as far back as May of 1991, 1 year after Susan Negersmith was sexually assaulted. There's a clear legislative intent for retroactive application of the 2002 DNA exception, and the appellate division erred in not finding so. The appellate division also found that the application of the DNA exception to this case violated the ex post facto laws by relying on a factually and legally distinguishable case, Stogner versus California. Stogner never addressed DNA evidence and did not apply to unknown persons. Now, the defendant argues that Stogner's language limiting its application to known offenders is irrelevant to the holding, and that it only is an explanation of the unfairness. Respectfully, I disagree. The language was intentional and critical. The court found an ex post facto violation because the amendment reviving the action, quote, retroactively withdraws a complete defense to prosecution after it has already attached, and it does so in a manner that allows the state to withdraw this defense at will and with respect to individuals already identified. Stogner involved a revival statute. Let me take a step back. That was their ex post facto holding, and it clearly was in that language. That language was clearly within that holding.
Counsel?
Yes.
Can a statute of limitations be told after it is expired?
That is a very good question, Your Honor, and that is the crux of this case. A statute of limitations, I would argue that the statute of limitations, the 2002 DNA exception, while it has been called a tolling exception, it also creates a new triggering event. And I think that that is where it applies more directly in this situation. The statute of limitations did expire, the one that applied in 1990, and that expired and we acknowledge that. But because Stogner held that that could not happen. Stogner was the case that held that a statute of limitations could not apply once it had told, or could not toll, excuse me, once it had been already expired. Our case is different from Stogner, and the underlying facts, the underlying avenues.
Put Stogner to one side.
Certainly.
How do you get around constitutional concerns if charges are brought after a statute of limitations has expired?
I would argue, Your Honor, that the statute of limitations does not change anything with respect to the crime as it was when it was originally committed. The crime is still the same. The sexual assault on the incapacitated person is still the same crime that was committed back then. The punishment does not change in the sense that the defendant would not be subject to punishment that was not in existence in 1990.
Stop there for a second.
Yes.
Let's look at it in a different way. This statute of limitations ran on May 28th of 1995, correct?
That's correct.
Could you have brought a prosecution on the day after, May 29th of 1995?
No.
So how then could a prosecution have been brought in 2022 in light of the ex post facto clause?
Because, Your Honor, of the nature of the statute that's in question, in that it essentially created a triggering event for very narrow and specific circumstances that we have in this present case, where we have a defendant who is not known, was not known at the time, and we have extremely reliable evidence.
How does that get around the protections in the Constitution that the ex post facto clause provides?
The ex post facto clause provides protections for where the protection that's provided for the defendant is that he does not have to mount a defense where memory has faded, evidence lost, witnesses become unavailable. The DNA evidence that is at issue in this very case and that is addressed in that 2002 exception means that certain pieces of that evidence is not lost. It is very reliable and it continues on. So it undermines the ultimate protection that the ex post facto law does try to provide.
But the legal consequences, and there are very serious consequences in a case such as this, of course, those legal consequences ended on May 28th of 1995. Your argument would change that. Doesn't that violate the ex post facto clause?
In a technical sense, it does. But I think the ex post facto clause and the nature of the statutes in question, this is not a question that goes to an affirmative defense. This is not a question that goes to the elements of the crime. This is not the statute of limitations really is, it adjusts the time span that allows for prosecution. It protects the ability to prosecute someone when you have the information, but it hasn't been resolved. And it's a very, very small circumstance if that applies to you.
Could the legislature today pass a law that tolls the statute of limitations for any crimes that are unresolved and apply that retroactively?
No, not in a general sense. I do not believe that is the case.
But isn't that the extension of what you're asking us to consider? You're asking for a carve out where any unsolved crime of this nature that occurred at any point where DNA is discovered and a suspect is solely identified by DNA, that would revive the case and do away with the statute of limitations.
Well, that is not true for certain cases, for example, the homicide cases and now sexual assault. So it would be, it really applied to a very narrow window of cases beforehand. Cases with respect to like robbery, for example, that kind of case, the Twiggs case addressed that to a certain degree, but that would not, it would apply back under those circumstances because of the time in which it was done, it was enacted. However, we're not looking at a broad brush application. This is such a narrow circumstance I'm not aware of any other case that is like this under the circumstances. And I don't think we are asking this court to say that for all cases under those circumstances, it would apply that way. We are saying that we're dealing with a very narrow set of circumstances under this that would be accepted and are different from the case, which is the fundamental holding that is Stogner, and I recognize I'm to step away from Stogner, but it is different. It is a very small circumstance, and because of that small circumstance, and because we are not dealing with anything that changes the act that occurred at the time or changes the punishment that could be inflicted at the time, we're looking at a different animal.
Does it change the punishment in the sense that after the statute of limitations had expired in this case, the punishment would have been zero? And now, of course, there's a conviction in this case, it would be dramatically different.
Looking at it that way, yes, Your Honor, but that is, again, part of the issue that we have with respect to this case, is that shortly after this, there was a change that made the punishment apply regardless. And essentially, the 2002 amendment made that change. The 1996 amendment made that change by removing the statute of limitations with respect to sexual assaults, period. And that was not available at the time. And there are changes, and there have been changes for quite some time. The change when homicide got put into a category where there's no statute of limitations, it still is the same type of situation.
But I keep coming back to the ex post facto clause because mm-hmm. that's one thing that hasn't changed. And that's what, respectfully, I think you have to get around.
I understand that, Your Honor. And I think that the ex post facto clause has, it is still there. It is still viewed. I think that there are laws that are changing it. There's a case in Indiana, Quinn versus State, which I can give the courts a cite to, where a 1988 rape, the Indiana Court of Appeals found that there was no ex post facto violation for the application of a 2009 DNA extension of a statute of limitations to a 1988 rape that had a 5-year statute of limitations that had expired. And I think that that's still, that while the ex post facto clause is cemented in stone, the categories, the underlying categories that were set forth in Calder v. Bull, that this court and the Supreme Court have all relied on are still are in stone. The expansion, they have been read more expansively. And under initial, in earlier cases, such as Miller, I believe it was Miller, was the New Jersey case, Miller actually said that a statute of limitations doesn't fall within that second category of Calder that Stogner relied on. And so I think that while the fundamentals are still there, there are interpretations that are changing the ex post facto laws and broadening it. And I think Stogner is one of them that broadened the interpretation of the ex post facto law and broadened the categories that were there.
Can you clarify two things for me? One is not directly related to the question before us, but matter of curiosity. But first, do you read the 1996 amendment to the statute of limitations to apply retroactively?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. I think the language in the legislative history is very clear.
In 96?
In the 96 one and the 2002 one.
And I saw where the original, the amended finding was homicide.
That is correct.
And DNA revealed that this defendant was the perpetrator.
The DNA revealed that the statistical analysis, revealed that.
That's why you charged.
Yeah, yes, that's why he was charged, and that's why he was charged with sexual assault.
He was not charged with homicide.
I'm sorry?
He was not charged with homicide.
He was not.
The homicide statute of limitations has not and will not expire.
That is correct.
Is there a reason why we're here on the sexual assault?
Yes, because I think in evaluating the evidence that we had available, there were questions as to whether we could proceed on the homicide charge, and
You could proceed. The question is whether you win.
No, I think there's a question of whether we would proceed on the charge.
Proceed.
Yes, we could. Obviously, we could proceed, but whether or not we would be able to successfully mount that, and whether that would be appropriate under the circumstances.
This individual could be charged. There is DNA evidence. There is DNA evidence relevant to the homicide that a sexual assault took place, which you think you can prove.
The sexual assault, yes.
Okay.
But I think there are other questions as to with respect to the other elements, Your Honor.
I'm familiar with the other elements. I'm just asking, is there anything barring, you may not win. Prosecutors sometimes are called upon to pursue a case because they believe what happened, how it happened, why it happened, and that there's a possibility, reasonable probability of a conviction, but they may not win it.
I think that I was not party to that decision making. But I will answer to the best of my ability, Your Honor.
You've answered the question that I had.
The legal, the legal issue is there's no impediment in the ex post facto law or in the issue of retroactivity, the statute of limitations. That none of that applies to homicide prosecution in this case.
Yes, that is correct. For felony murder or homicide, either way, it would proceed. But that is, I think that based on what we knew and what the office felt at the time, that it would not have been just appropriate to proceed with those charges. So that decision was made, and I can acknowledge that that's what was done.
Justice Solomon had asked whether you thought that the 1996 amendment was retroactive, and you said definitely yes. But I'm looking at the 1996 amendment where it specifically says that the act shall take effect immediately and, quote, shall be applicable to all offenses not yet barred from prosecution under the statute of limitations as of the effective date. So that's the legislature saying that it's not retroactive as to cases where the statute of limitations has already run, right?
Yes, that's what that says. But there are also there were numerous amendments back then. And what the general rule was is that it clearly intended to have a retroactive effect because they put in that it would be looked, that you could look backward. And they contained the language take effect immediately, as well as the additional language that says it only applies or limits it to cases where the statute of limitations has not run. So in our mind, that is clearly an indication of retroactive effect with respect to the 1996 one. There are other various...
Just there's different forms of retroactivity.
Not fully retroactive.
Right. So you agree that it's not retroactive if the statute of limitations had already run at the time of the 1996 amendment. So for example, in this case, you agreed that the statute of limitations ran on May 28th, 1995.
That's correct.
It was then not revived in 1996 because the legislature specifically said, quote, shall be applicable to all offenses not yet barred from prosecution under the statute of limitations as of the effective date, whereas here this offense had been already barred from prosecution as of the effective date.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So when you're saying it's retroactive, you mean to cases where the statute of limitations had not already run?
The 96 amendment, in that case, the final amendment, yes, that is correct. There is the history, the legislative history of that amendment shows various attempts to address retroactivity. And there was clearly an intent for it to be retroactive, though maybe not necessarily to cases that were barred by the statute of limitations. But that's not to say that it was totally a prospective only statute of limitations, which is what the appellate court found. And the same is true with the 2002, is that there is clearly an intent to have it apply to cases that were in existence prior to its enactment.
Some cases, but not all cases.
I'm sorry.
It was retroactive as to some cases, but not all.
The 96 amendment, yes. That's correct.
And so, for example, a sexual assault case where the offense was committed in May of 1990 would not have benefited from the 1996 amendment, because the statute would already have run, correct?
Correct.
And the language in the 2002 amendment is different.
It is different, Your Honor, but the legislative history also shows an intent for it to apply retroactively.
But if I can interrupt you, what about it is ambiguous that would require us to go to the legislative history? Where it says this shall take effect immediately from that point forward, what gives us pause to look anywhere else?
The history of the statute. It's a statute of limitations. It essentially forces a look back. That's the nature of the beast. It's not like some statutes where you can just clearly make a black line. It does that. But the language in the legislative history does make you look back and does make you consider that. And that's part of what Lane said, is that you can also, you look back and you can find the intent of the legislature in the language as well as in the pertinent legislative history. And the language in the 2002 amendment is pretty clear. This bill would remove time limitations on the prosecution of crimes this is the legislative history. This bill would remove time limitations on the prosecution of crimes when the person who committed the crime is unknown at the time, but DNA evidence collected at the crime scene can be used to identify the person at a later time. The number of DNA profiles of criminals and suspects stored in state and federal DNA data banks is growing rapidly. This increase has overwhelmed crime labs and caused significant backlogs in the analysis of DNA evidence. This has resulted in cases where prosecuting authorities have matched DNA evidence with a DNA profile but have been barred from bringing charges against the suspect on the grounds that the statute of limitations on the crime had expired. Under the bill, authorities would not be barred from prosecuting such crimes in the state. Statutes of limitation establish a time period following the commission of a crime after which a prosecution cannot be commenced. The traditional rationale for these statutes is to protect defendants from the use of stale evidence against them. But this rationale is weakened by advances in DNA technology. DNA evidence that has been properly collected from a crime scene, handled and stored, can reliably identify defendants many years after a crime has been committed. That clearly shows that they are looking to apply it retroactively and going backwards.
Well, what in the language of the 2002 amendments indicates that it's applicable to these sexual assault offenses that the legislature already addressed in the 1996 amendment? So by 2002, there had already been no statute of limitations for sexual assault offenses for over 6 years, correct?
Yes.
And in 1996, at the point at which the legislature made that amendment that sexual assault offenses were no longer going to be subject to a statute of limitations, it was very clear that the legislature did not encompass within that new eliminated statute of limitations cases for which the statute of limitations had already expired. So by 2002, there was no category of sexual assault cases for which they had been committed under the previous 5-year statute of limitations regime that had not already expired. Do you see what I'm saying?
I do understand what you're saying, and I think that that's one of the things that the bill was specifically addressed, cases like the one I have here, is where we have a situation where we have this solid evidence, where we have been searching and trying to find the person, and we finally find them 30 years later and are now in a situation where we can't probably prove the homicide, but we are looking at a sexual assault that we can prove, and we feel very strongly that we can prove sexual assault against an incapacitated person.
Again, in 1996, the legislature had already made clear everything before this statute, the effective date of this statute, that for which the statute of limitations had already expired, those are out. I mean, you would agree with that. I think you agree with that.
Yes, we agree with the 96 amendment.
Those are out.
Saying that those are out.
So I don't see anything in the 2002 amendments that revives those cases and counters what the legislature amended in 1996.
The language of the actual amendment does not say that. It does not say revive. What it does do is it changes the trigger of the statute of limitations for a very narrow type of case, which is the case that we have here. By changing the trigger, and I think that the legislative history supports and suggests that it is intended to apply to cases such as ours, that where we've had this evidence for a long period of time, but the language of the amendment itself, other than changing the trigger date, does not address that situation or does not specifically say we are reviving old cases.
Counselor. And because the 2002 amendments don't just apply to sexual assault cases.
Agreed.
And again, by 2002, there was no need to toll anything with regard to sexual assault cases because there was no statute of limitations.
I understand.
You see what I mean? So at the time that the legislature was enacting this amendment with regard to this DNA evidence, any sexual assault cases, this wasn't even applicable post-1996.
I can understand that. I disagree. We disagree with that, and which is why we proceeded with this, but I understand that interpretation, Your Honor. And I can't really say that, except to the extent that the legislative history suggests that the case that we have is one that is, and there's been extensive legislative involvement with respect to this case, which I think the amicus will be addressing.
I'm sorry. It's similar to the discussion you had previously with regard to homicide. This DNA exception has nothing to do with homicide cases, you would agree?
I would agree.
At all?
At all.
Because there's no statute of limitations. So when the legislature was amending this 2002, I think it's a reasonable interpretation that the legislature wasn't even thinking about homicide cases the same way that they probably weren't thinking about sexual assault cases, that they had kind of handled the statute of limitations issue 6 years prior.
I can understand that, Your Honor. I think some of the legislative history suggests otherwise, that they were contemplating cases of this sort. However, I can't come up with any specific thing to address that that's in the language of the statute.
And doesn't other parts of the legislative history cut against your argument in terms of, I'm looking at the sponsor statement. Specifically, it says, quote, this Senate substitute would toll the applicable statute of limitations for the commission of a crime in certain cases until the state is in possession of DNA or fingerprint evidence taken from the suspect. A statute of limitations cannot be tolled if it has already expired because there is simply nothing to toll. It would need to be revived first, and then it could be tolled. But here they're specifically just saying the Senate substitute would toll the applicable statute of limitations in certain cases. They're not saying in every case. It seems like they're acknowledging that where the statute of limitations has already run and expired, there is simply nothing to toll. Is your position that you can toll a statute of limitations after it has expired?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that is our position. Our position is that we are, that this is essentially created a new starting point for a statute of limitations in a situation that fell in between all of the cracks in a way that was very unfortunate for the victim and her family. And we finally have the information available to prosecute someone and are in a position where we struggle to do that. And that is, there is a fairness, there's a fairness on the side of the defendant that is accept that I understand, and I think that we all understand, and as prosecutors, we understand. There is a fairness to the victim where their case is eliminated based on a dated or maybe not, based on a dated sense of evidence. And that's the basis for the ex post facto law, and that's the basis for a lot of these laws. And we are stuck with a situation where if this sexual assault had occurred in 1991, we wouldn't be here. And we're faced with a situation where we have a case, there could be a case brought in 1991 or 1992 for sexual assault that is not barred by the statute of limitations, that relies on less evidence and less significant evidence or less reliable and accurate evidence than we have from a case from 1990, and we can't do anything about it. And there's an inherent frustration with that.
Statutes of limitations are sometimes cited as an example when people make arguments based on arbitrariness and the unfairness that necessarily results from arbitrariness. And there's a lot of law, obviously, here and elsewhere that says the legislature can make a call on a statute of limitations, and there are going to be people who in cases that fall on one side or the other of that, and that's simply a legislative determination.
That is correct. And I've seen, and I think this case and the statutes that we're talking about show an intent to try and do something about that. But it may not work, it may fall flat, but it is still a tremendous frustration that this is a matter of timing in a lot of respects.
That's on your answer to Justice Winter-Raptor just minutes ago. I think you said these amendments changed the starting point for the statute of limitations.
Yes.
Something, in fact, changed the end point for the statute of limitations.
Well, the way the 2002 amendment reads, the statute of limitations doesn't start until after the state is in possession of the physical evidence from the crime and the DNA evidence to compare against it for purposes of identifying the defendant or the suspect or the actor, offender, whichever term you wish to choose. But so in a sense, it is the starting point is changed. It's changed to when you have both of those pieces of evidence in place, and then you have to file, and then you have to deal with it after that.
Anything else you'd like to add?
At this point, no, I will save my other comments for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Pompilia.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My purpose as amicus, was to try to enlighten this court on my involvement in the legislative history. Since I was involved in it, it was a little bit difficult because I didn't want to submit things to the court, which I had no proof of, but I believe it's clearly important because this time period, meaning between 1990-91 and 2001-2002, when the statute, the latest amendment was enacted, was truly the most, in my opinion, the most volatile time, and I use that word loosely, in the history of the criminal justice system in this state. It just wasn't a normal legislative functioning. And I hear comments like, well, the legislature thought this. And if I could just address that a moment. In 1991, you had the culmination of the victims' rights movement with the passage of the Victims' Rights Amendment. That was the first human rights amendment to the New Jersey Constitution since 1844. We cited Muhammad extensively in our brief, because I think Mohammed is really the critical case when anybody addresses the issue of victims' rights. And here was the tenor at the time. The death penalty was still in New Jersey. We had, I think, by 1990, we had over 30 people on death row. The Supreme Court in the 80s, they were rendering decisions like Jackson was one of them, where you had to find intent in the murder. And that ended up with the prosecutors pushing to have the Constitution amended, which they did to remove that. So in 1992, the legislature and the executive branch changed. So you had all of this activity, and I would say because they changed, it was conflict to a certain degree. And in all of that, and then 1994, you had Megan's Law, and that was a major activity on behalf of the executive branch and the legislative branch to address the issue of sexual assault. And that ignited in the early 90s, at the same exact time that we were trying to get justice for Susan Negersmith by filing a lawsuit against the medical examiner who refused to correct the death certificate. And as I indicated in my brief, there was so much news going on about this case. I mean, the stack of news articles is this high. There were so many TV pieces about it. And I say that only because in the mind of the legislature, in the mind of people, of prosecutors, in the criminal justice system, this case was very well known. The ultimate sponsors of the bill that passed in 2001, too, were two of the most strongest advocates for victims' rights, Senators Allen and, I forgot his name, he was from Bergen County. But it was there. Susan Negersmith's case was there. And it was there when it went to the legislature. And unfortunately, in 1995, when they were looking to amend the legislation, they couldn't agree on too much. Politics was still changing. And the best they got out of it in that period was the 96 statute. Obviously, that wasn't satisfactory for the purpose of indicting or finding someone to arrest in Susan's rape and murder. But nevertheless, the Negersmith issue stayed with the legislature, and it stayed heavier because there was such a desire to fix. And I say this to you candidly, because I know I was there for much of it. There was such a desire on the part of the legislature to fix the injustice of Negersmith, and that was part of it, I believe, because the way she had been so disregarded as a human. Within 30 days of the day she was killed, the county prosecutor closed the case. The Negersmiths found out. They closed the case by reading something in the newspaper. What kept this alive was the Negersmiths. It's the oldest case in my office. It's now 32 years old. And Mr. Negersmith was relentless. He was relentless with the legislature. He was relentless with Governor Whitman's office. And from what I know, that ultimately led to the 2001-2002 amendment. So as I see it, the difficulty is they didn't do it right. That's part of the problem. They didn't do it right. They didn't have enough agreeable evidence on DNA that it could have been in a statute within time. That's the truth, whether it helps this case or it hurts this case. My obligation is to be totally candid with Your Honors, and that is the truth. That is the fact. And as I see it, this statute was intended to address the Nagler-Smith case, did it properly, did it legally. That's going to be your decision.
You're saying when you say this statute, the 2002 amendment, or both?
It's 2002 amendment.
Because 1995 seems, the language would suggest that this case was not in mind.
Yeah, well, they ran out of time, what it was. So I don't know if I have any more to give you on the issue of statute of legislative intent. I don't want to cross the line, and please understand that.
Assume everything that you've said is correct, and we accept it. The Appellate Division in its analysis goes one step further and says, if these statutes are retroactive, there's a constitutional problem, the ex post facto.
Yes. How do I address that? Well, I guess it depends. Don't you hate it when a lawyer said it depends? It depends on how one views the statute of limitations vis-a-vis the ex post facto law. Now, I went back and looked at the history of the ex post facto law and went all the way back, because I had time this week, to the Federalist Papers and reading comments by Madison and Hamilton. And they spoke just of the most egregious conduct that had gone on with respect to the colonists. And then that's led to the ex post facto laws. When a man commits an act on Monday, and he's tried and convicted on Tuesday, and on Wednesday, they pass another law saying it's double the penalty. They were blatant. And all of these examples are blatant. And if I may be so bold as to say, that was the foundation of the criminal justice system in this country. It was a foundation that had no rights for people charged. They called them criminals in the Constitution, but no rights for people who were charged with a crime. If you look at the first Constitution of New Jersey, the 1776 Constitution, the only right a defendant has is, I think it's Article 16, and it says essentially that the rights of criminals shall be equal to the rights of witnesses and the prosecution. It's the prosecution was up here, the state was up here, and individuals, people charged, had no rights at all. And in the last 200 years, that's what has happened in the criminal justice system. It's gone from here to here. And it wasn't until 1980, after almost 200 years, that somebody decided to take a look at the impact of the criminal justice system on not the criminals, but that are other people in the criminal justice system, namely the victims. And in 1980, there was a task force commissioned by President Reagan. And it was an extensive task force, and it went all over the country. And I think they went into seven cities and they interviewed victims of crime. And I think there were like 146 victims they interviewed at length. And the end result of that was a report in 1982 submitted to the president. And the chairperson of the task force said, and I'm quoting her, "Somewhere along the way, the system began to serve the lawyers and judges and defendants and treat victims with institutionalized disinterest." It went on to say the treatment of crime victims is a national disgrace. The institutionalized disinterest, we know what that is. And that is crime victims. And crime victims includes the people were kept out of the system.
Mr. Pompilio, you've done immense work in the area of victims' rights, and this court's opinions on the subject have likewise focused on the importance of victims' rights. As you understand the law, can an individual be prosecuted, charged, after the statute of limitations has run under our federal constitution?
As I understand the law, one Supreme Court decision is no, but that wasn't a DNA case. And I think DNA is the difference here, because this is why I discussed the history. Because when you look back at all the, not all of them, but many of the ex post facto cases, they talk about what? They talk about fairness, and they talk about a balancing to a certain degree. They talk about, and I think, if I may.
You're referring to Stogner versus California. Is that the case you're referring
yes,
to?
Yes, ma'am. Yes. Zerinsky is a New Jersey Supreme Court case. Our legislature has determined that the societal interest in punishing the guilty is so strong with respect to certain crimes that the countervailing concern of protecting persons from prosecution for crimes in the distant past is wholly overcome. I take that to mean that it's not an automatic, hard, fast rule. I take that to mean that when you are looking at whether this is an ex post facto law because of the statute of limitations, nevertheless, you still have to balance the equities in the situation. And I think that's absolutely critical, because there have been two game changers in this 200 plus year history of the criminal justice system. One was victims' rights. It changed the tenor completely in the criminal justice system. It added a victim to the equation. But also, it enables us to look back at the history of these laws that we've had since the beginning of our nation. And what caused an ex post facto law to be an ex post facto law? Horrible, egregious, unfair, unjust conduct. But that's not what we're talking about.
But we have Stogner. And I understand there's a distinction between Stogner and this case, because in Stogner, the defendant was identified throughout that period. But Stogner suggests that ex post facto concerns would be raised if there was a retroactive application of the 2002 amendment in this case.
And I think, I mean, in looking at that case, was it Justice Breyer? I'm sorry, I forget. It was Justice Breyer. Justice Breyer went long and hard. Remember, that was a 5-4 decision. Went long and hard. There was nothing in the list of items that fall into this ex post facto laws. He worked long and hard to find statute of limitations and interpreted, I think it was the third. He interpreted it to that. But that's not only.
But the U.S. Supreme Court is the final arbiter of federal constitutional law.
Absolutely.
Even in 5-4 decisions, of which there are many.
That's why I say that there's a distinction between the two cases, because one involved just adding on another year to the statute of limitations. Okay, you have 5 years within which, or the statute expired, we're just going to add another year. That's arbitrary, and most importantly, it's not based on any rational understanding or any rational base to provide fairness. That's the point. What DNA does is that. In every case we find, not every case, but many cases, the courts talk about the fairness of finding truth, the fairness to the defendant. That's what's so utterly amazing about when you look at this from and you step back and look at the facts of this case. The idea of the ex post facto law is to prevent somebody from being harmed, even if they committed a crime. The case we have before you is so far different. Will there eventually be the case? I'm sure there will be if this isn't it. But DNA changes everything, because to me, it changes what's behind the defendant to protect him. Now, DNA protects the defendant, obviously, as much as it protects anyone else. So, if I don't mean to be skirting your question, Mr. Chief Justice. Let me put it this way. I believe there is a distinction between Stogner and this case and some of the other cases we cited. I mean, I'm not aware of any case that has challenged the federal DNA statute. I'm aware of cases that have tested it and interpreted it, and I question, well, why didn't the defendant file an ex post facto claim? Because if you decide against the prosecution in this case, don't we have to a certain degree a difference between the federal law and the state law? I think it was it Hagler? And Hagler, there was a 2000 robbery, a 2008 DNA hit. They upheld it. And again, when I look at the, I have some quotes from Hagler, when DNA evidence is available, the reasons for having a statute of limitations are significantly attenuated. Or put another way, the federal statute extends the limitations period in DNA cases because DNA evidence is uniquely precise.
Are you saying that Hagler held that a prosecution could be revived after the statute of limitations had already run without offending the ex post facto clause?
I don't believe it did. I mean, if you read it and I did it, I'll trust your reading. But
are you aware of other cases that have so held?
I have to think on the federal level, there's Hagler and, I'm sorry, there was another case. I think it's cited in the state's brief or our brief. I don't know why the federal statute has not been challenged. And I think that question, I wish I had more time to come up with an answer, but that gives me pause as to why it is the process is going one way in the federal courts and then perhaps different in the state. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to invite you to try to bring your argument.
I'll bring it to an end right now. Thank you. I appreciate your time. Thank you. It's always an honor to have the voice of crime victims be presented to this court. It means so much to the victims' community throughout the state, and I truly believe that it has enhanced the quality of justice in this state. Thank you.
Thank you, Council.